Starting right on time at 8:30 sharp, it's time to open the House Rural Communities Land Use and Water Committee. This is our little quarterly interim meeting. Welcome everybody on the committee. Hope everyone's having a good fall and hunting season. Representative Witt?
Not for me.
No? I had some luck last week, so I'm happy. I have meat.
You're sharing.
We are, yeah, I'll share the meat. It's frozen in the car. I'll just start unloading it a little later down below. Let's get into our, since we're right on time, let's get right into our Oregon drought update. So I'll open an informational meeting and ask the three come together. The first three, well, the only three panelists, Lori Onan, Tom Beiler, and Raquel Rancier. I know, I've known her forever. I still don't know how to pronounce her name. I just call her Raquel. So welcome and tell us about the challenges of water in Oregon.
Thank you and good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Lori Onan. I'm a policy advisor in Governor Brown's Natural Resources Office. And I'm pleased to be here with Tom Beiler and Raquel Rancier with the Water Resources Department. Appreciate the invitation. So we can go to the next slide. We're going to tag team, taking you through the conditions Oregon experienced this year and what we may expect for the future, the impacts of drought that we saw this year, and how Oregon is responding. And here's a map. It's the U.S. Drought Monitor map. It's prepared weekly by the U.S. Department of Agriculture and NOAA National Weather Service. It's based on data about conditions including precipitation, stream flow, reservoir storage, vegetation health, and indicators of soil moisture. And we put this slide here because now that the rain has started falling again, thankfully, you may wonder if that's taking care of the drought. And you can see from this map, it's dated November 10, that's last week. And it shows that all of Oregon is still in drought based on the conditions that they look at. Red and dark orange show where drought is still severe or extreme, and the light orange is moderate drought. So the takeaway is that drought has lasting impacts and recovery takes time even after it starts to rain. Now I'm going to turn it over to Raquel.
Good morning, Chair Clem and committee members. For the record, Raquel Rancier with the Water Resources Department. So I'm going to take you through the conditions that we saw this year and what led up to this year's drought across the state. If you take a look at this map here, you'll see on the left we have precipitation. And this is precipitation between October and December of 2014. We begin in October because it's the beginning of the water year. So if you take a look at that, you'll see that we had pretty good rainfall at the beginning of the water year. That turquoise shows that rainfall was above average, and the white area shows that it was about normal. But if you look to the right, you'll see that there is the temperature for the state. And you'll see there that the coastal range, for example, in the western part of the state, experienced that dark red, which is the record warmest. This is a record that started in 1895. So we had a very warm October to December. If we look into January through September to finish out the water year, you'll see that conditions, particularly on the western side for precipitation, became drier than normal. So that color that you're seeing there for the coastal range is much below average precip. And then over into the eastern side, it's below average. If you look to the right, you'll see that the temperature across the state was that dark red, which is, again, the record warmest. So you'll see we had the fifth driest for this January-September period, and then the record warmest for also that January-September period of time during the historic record. Well, for starters, this means that we had a very poor snowpack, to say the least. If you take a look at this graph here, you'll see that that red line at the very bottom, that line is this year's snowpack. The rest of the lines up there, you'll see the grays, that's the historic snowpack. And you'll see in many instances that the red line is much below that historic snowpack. If you look at the dotted line, that is the average. So that average there shows where snowpack typically peaks, and as you can see here, it peaked much lower than normal, and it also melted off much earlier than normal. And in some areas of the state, you'll see that there wasn't much of a peak either. So let's take a look at why this is important. Snowpack is a storage reservoir. If you take a look at this hydrograph, the red line was this 2015 stream flow for Salmon River near Government Camp. So this area gets snow, as well as rain, but snow primarily for its system. You'll see that the blue line is the average. So that's what you would typically see in an average year. If you look at the snowpack, then you'll see that the line, the peak of the snowpack, lines up with when you start to see the stream flows increase. And as that snow melt, that snow melts off, the stream flows peak. So what that means this year is that if you look at the red, we didn't really have a peak snowpack in the Willamette. And as you can see, that showed in the hydrograph. As a result, we didn't get that storage this year that we would typically get. So stream flows were quite low even in April. And this system looks more like a flashier system that you would expect of a rain-driven system versus a snow-driven system. In addition, we also had lower than normal precip. So in areas of the state that don't rely as much on snowpack, we still saw low stream flows. Also recall that temperature is a key theme here. This record warm temperatures really was a huge factor in the drought this year and also driving these lower than normal stream flows. So this shows stream flows in June, and that not bright red color, but the kind of moderate red color there is much below normal, and the bright red is very low. And you'll see that many parts of the state experienced much below normal stream flows, and that's from June. This also means that many areas of the state began drawing on reservoirs earlier than normal, which means that by August, this graph here shows the percent of average that we typically see. And so some areas of the state, for example, were pretty low, Eastern Oregon. Owyhee Reservoir hasn't filled in several years. And as you can see here, they every year have been drawing down those reservoirs pretty significantly. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Director Beiler to talk more about drought.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tom Beiler. I'm the director at the Oregon Water Resources Department. So I want to segue into a whole conversation about our response to drought and how the state and others are able to address the effects and impacts that occur around the state. And in the slide that you see here, the larger map of the state shows the drought monitor, different levels of intensity of drought. And as you can see, most of this state is in red, which is an extreme drought condition, a D3. And the remainder is in an orange hue, D2, which is severe drought. For the federal government, if an area is in a D2 status, a severe drought status, for 8 consecutive weeks, the federal government automatically declares a drought situation, which then triggers in resources, primarily funding resources, either through the Farm Services Agency or the Natural Resources Conservation Service. In Oregon, we approach things a little bit differently. And in the top left-hand corner, you'll see the map of the state with county designations. We have the ability, or the mechanism here is to go through a drought declaration, emergency drought declaration process, whereby counties become involved and respond to local concerns, local needs, and then make a request to the governor through the Oregon Emergency Management Division to declare a drought emergency. This year we had 25 of 36 counties make those drought declarations, as you can see in the map. Now, when those drought emergencies are declared in the state, that kicks into gear a couple of different things. What we have then is a coordinated response through heightened communications among interested and key agencies at the local, state, and federal level. The governor's office would have monthly meetings this summer, throughout the course of the summer, to hear from local stakeholder representatives from agriculture and business, as well as federal agencies and state agencies and local government. Our agency would have weekly updates to monitor the situation on the ground. But also, from a statutory standpoint, a number of tools become available when an emergency is declared, which allow for temporary water use authorizations, either temporary transfers, temporary permits. These permits tend to be in the form of emergency wells that can be drilled to allow for groundwater use to supplant surface water, which is no longer available due to the drought conditions. We also have a tool that allows for preferences for stock water or human consumption use, so they can be those uses can be made despite their prior appropriation senior regulatory system that we have, recognizing those are important uses in communities around the state. These emergency tools have an expedited review process. We try to, when we receive these applications, we try to move on those within 10 days. And this year, this summer, we received 64 permit applications from different parts of the state, as well as 25 transfers. So those are, again, those are emergency tools where folks are trying to address the consequences of the drought conditions to the best of their ability.
One moment, Tom.
Yeah.
Representative McLean.
Tom, were those 64 applicants for new wells or existing wells that they wanted to use?
Mr. Chair, Representative McLean, I don't have specifics on that, but my hunch is that it's a combination of the two. We have a number of areas where, for example, in the Klamath, where we've had drought declared a number of, 10 out of the last 15 years, I believe. And in some cases, folks have already drilled their wells, and they're just applying for new permits to be able to access the water from those wells. There are other areas where maybe they're facing the situation for the first time and they'll need to drill a well in order to be able to access that water.
And do you roughly, do you have an estimate of the cost of a well? So at, at 100 feet, at 200 feet, I'm just trying to gauge if folks are having to pop wells and it's a new cost, what are we looking at, a $10,000 invoice to a rancher?
Mr. Chair, Representative McLean, I'm going to look over at, as I respond, I'm going to look over at Raquel to see if her eyes pop out of her head, but I'm going to ballpark this around maybe anywhere from $30,000 to $40,000 might be the cost to drill a well, and it really can range depending on how deep you have to go.
Okay, thank you.
It's a big expense. We can move to the next slide. So a drought emergency is a it has a broad impact on communities around the state, and I know that you all know this, my experience is that it's a different kind of it's a different nature of an emergency than I think that we're accustomed to. There's not a tsunami on the horizon. The hills are not ablaze in fire. The earth is not shaking. The town is not being flooded. It's not an immediate dramatic impact. It's more slow and pervasive. And that makes it challenging in some respects because it doesn't get as the same level of attention both on the front end and sometimes in the response. It's slow moving, but its impacts are real. And as you can see in this slide, there are a number of different sectors within our communities that can be impacted by drought. Most obviously, and what we hear about most, because most of the water use is within agriculture and irrigated agriculture, can have a dramatic impact, as we just discussed, folks who need to make the expense to have a backup system to drill a well. It can wreak havoc in terms of the timing of the need for water. We found this year, because of the temperatures, that folks needed to make use of their water earlier in the season than they typically did. They also needed to use more water during certain parts of the year because the temperatures were higher than typical. We also found that many of the water users were being regulated off earlier in the season than typical because of the conditions. And in some parts of the state, in the Willamette Valley and the coast, folks were being regulated that were not accustomed to that activity. Folks in eastern Oregon, the dry side of the state, that's part of life. People know about the water rights system. They know about and can plan for regulation because it's a normal part of their experience. On the east side and the dry side of the state, that regulation happened to more and more senior rights because of the conditions we had. On the west side, we found ourselves spending a lot of time educating folks about the nature of their water rights and the fact that that in some cases they had to be regulated off because of the conditions we have this year. Obviously, wildfires. We have had very tough forest fire seasons for a number of years now. Drought conditions certainly exacerbate that. Community water suppliers do a fine job of being prepared and having backup systems, but some community water suppliers, especially the smaller systems, they need resources, they need technical help, and to make sure that they are building in the redundancies in their systems so that when we have extraordinary years like we did this year, that they're able to continue to provide water for their citizens. We also have impacts on water quality and fish. You may have seen over the course of the summer restrictions on fishing associated with the rising temperatures in streams around the state limited the ability for recreational fishing in parts of the state. Anytime or if you ever drove by the Detroit Reservoir, you would have a clear understanding of the impacts on recreation given the low reservoir there. This occurred in other parts of the state as well. And, of course, groundwater is an area of increasing concern and interest for us and many users around the state. Most of the state surface water supplies have been fully appropriated. Folks are going to groundwater more and more for new uses. Those aquifers, in some cases, have limited supplies. Drought tends to exacerbate the pressures on those systems as more uses occur. Go to the next slide, please. So looking ahead, the maps you have in front of you show a three-month outlook between October 15th and January 31st. This was developed by the NOAA weather folks. And on the top left-hand corner, you'll see for that period of time, in the orange and yellow hues, those are areas where where it's expected that we'll have above normal temperatures over between this period, again, through the end of January 2016. On the lower left corner, you'll see that this deals with precipitation. And for a good part of the state, southwest and southwest, it's an equal chance that we'll receive normal precipitation during that time period. But parts of eastern Oregon and northeast Oregon, there's a greater chance of below normal precipitation. On the right-hand side, you'll see the brown patch that covers Washington, most of Idaho, parts of Nevada, Northern California. And essentially what they're concluding based on this outlook is that drought will persist and intensify in those areas that are shaded in brown. Next slide. This shows a graphic of what is predicted by many climate change scientists around the predicted scenario that we're going to have from a temperature and precipitation standpoint. And primarily temperature is the key issue here. Even with strong precipitation, if we have higher temperatures moving forward, it is going to have a dramatic shift on how and when we experience water flows as a result of diminished snowpack. And as you can see in those maps, that the green color shows rain-dominant systems. The red and the blue show either a mix of snow and rain or snow systems. And as you can see by under this scenario, by 2040 and 2080, that we will be in a rain-dominated system. So I'm not a climate scientist. I don't know whether this will pan out or not. But if we do head in that direction, there's a lot that we need to do to be prepared for that. If we can move to the next slide, please. One of the things that the Water Resources Department has done in recent years is our commission has adopted an integrated water resources strategy, which is our compass. It's our roadmap. It helps us prioritize our actions in working with the water user community around the state. And it's really based on four very basic ideas. One is that we need to understand the resource. We need to have a good idea of where the water is, the timing of those of the resource. We need to also understand what our needs are, both today and going into the future. We need to understand the different pressures that that impact the needs, whether it's climate change scenarios or population changes or demographic changes. We need to also understand and use those combination of things to develop game plans to meet those needs. One of the things that we're very excited about, Raquel, if you could move to the next slide. One of the things that we're very excited about over recent years, and many thanks to the state legislature on this, is that a number of new programs have been developed that provide more long-term and meaningful tools for communities to address their long-term water supply needs. The short-term emergency tools that we provide are stopgap measures. They do not help in the long term in terms of community needs in areas where we're facing long-term drought scenarios. One of the so there are a number of different programs that have been developed in statute, in rule, as well as funding that has been provided by the legislature that we're very grateful for, and we're really at the threshold of being able of starting to unroll these programs in communities around the state. And this is we call this our Water Resources Development Program. And in this slide, you'll see the dark blue circle is the program, and here we're just conveying that there are two core elements to this. One is resources, funding through grants and loans that provide for planning. They provide technical feasibility study types of grants as well as project grants, and I'll talk about those in a little more detail in just a minute. But the other element that we provide are staff resources, boots on the ground to work with communities to provide technical assistance for them, to help them, guide them in terms of their options and from a planning standpoint as well as a technical standpoint. So we are excited to have these resources, both staff capacity and grant loan funds, and we are hearing from communities around the state a great deal of interest in engaging in efforts to help address their future needs. So let me talk a little bit more about the grant and loan programs. The funding that you see here is a combination of funding from this current biennium as well as some carry forward dollars from the 2013 biennium. And there are the core elements are around planning, and there's $750,000 that was appropriated for a pilot program that we're starting this biennium that we call place-based planning. And the idea around place-based planning is to bring a community together, the various diverse interests that exist in that community, to engage in discussion around those principles that I talked about with the Integrated Water Resources Strategy, and that is, what are your resources? What's the current status of your resources? What are your needs? What are your future needs? What are the drivers that are affecting those resources? And what ideas do you have as a community about potential projects that can help address those future needs? It's our opinion that we think this is a really strong foundation to build by empowering communities to engage in those conversations and to build the social and political will to be able to move forward on trying to realize projects. Projects are very, very difficult. Water projects, I know some of you have experience in your district where individuals are trying to, or groups are trying to move forward on water projects, and they are not easy lifts at all. We're hoping that these planning projects will help build a stronger foundation for that in the long term. We have $8.8 million of feasibility grant funds. These are grants that help folks assess the technical merits of potential project ideas, whether it's from an engineering standpoint or an environmental assessment or economic assessment. It helps ground truth and test the viability of project ideas that can then lead to moving forward on specific project implementation. The next two items involve grant and loan funds through two different programs. One is the Water Supply Development Grant Loans, $14 million, that are through what was Senate Bill 839 from the 2013 session. This is a new program that was developed through a collaborative effort of many stakeholders, discussions that we're just launching now. We adopted rules right at the end of the previous biennium. We have a current solicitation for grants and loan applications that I believe that's open until mid-January. Our expectation is that our commission will make decisions on potential projects by spring of 2016 under this program. We also, the legislature allocated $30 million of, let me back up just one second if I may, on the $14 million is lottery bond revenue. In fact, the previous two, there were all lottery bond revenue. Sorry, I failed to mention that. The Water Development Loan Fund is a constitutional fund that provides general obligation bond authority for the department to issue loans for water development projects. It's less broad in terms of the eligibility and the recipients. These are for small communities, small municipalities, as well as agricultural projects. But it provides a loan fund option for folks to be able to try to jumpstart projects dealing with their water supply needs. And the last two areas I wanted to mention aren't part of our formal program, our water resource development program, but are related. And I just wanted to put on your radar screen, we received $1 million specifically to help address a commingling issue in the basalt aquifer systems in the Mosier area along the Columbia River. Those are highly fractured aquifer system where we're having problems with some of the wells that were constructed in that area that essentially are creating a commingling among the different strata and aquifers within that system. And the $1 million there is to help repair many of those wells so that they're functioning appropriately and helping to shore up that water supply system there. And lastly, at the Umatilla Basin, we've been working, and the legislature is well aware that there's been an effort underway for many years to try to develop water out of the Columbia, which requires bucket-for-bucket mitigation. $11 million of grant funds through lottery bonds were appropriated for that project. We're working closely with the proponents of that project, as well as Water Watch of Oregon and others, with the hope of being able to move on that project in the coming months. I think with that, I'm going to pass the baton to Lori.
Thank you. And this is a slide that shows some of the efforts the governor undertook this year. She is closely tracking drought issues, very concerned about the effects of drought on Oregon's communities. Tom mentioned the emergency drought declarations that were issued in two-thirds of Oregon's counties this year. He also mentioned the Oregon Drought Team, which was meeting monthly to share information about drought conditions and impacts across Oregon. And then there was Executive Order 1509, in which the governor ordered state agencies to adopt water conservation measures and directed updates of the state's planning for drought. Basically, under the executive order, agencies are directed to take actions to reduce non-essential water use by 15% in an aggregate amount by 2020. And the real idea there was for the state to lead by example in making smarter use of water and conserving where water use is non-essential. Letting people know about the impacts of drought, because as Tom mentioned, it is sometimes a slow-moving disaster that the impacts aren't readily noticeable, and especially when it starts raining, people may wonder, gee, it's all good now, and the fact is it has these lingering impacts that continue to affect communities and agriculture and other issues. Agencies are also directed to look at the emergency plans for drought to see if there's lessons learned from this year that could inform better communication and coordination going forward. And then, of course, as the Integrated Water Resources Strategy is updated by Water Resources Department, look at where it can be bolstered to increase Oregon's resiliency to drought for the long term. And so this slide is just things that we're looking at to be more resilient to drought going forward. We have started engaging stakeholders in conversations about what are the best next step. And I just wanted to highlight some of the things we're looking at, and you heard Tom allude to them a little bit in his presentation. Do we have the tools we need for short-term drought response needs? Are there additional tools that will help improve that response? Small rural communities often have the most trouble with drought and understanding their water rights and other ways they can address water supply issues. So are there things we can do to help them better anticipate and plan for drought? For example, could there be assistance for them to prepare water conservation and management plans? We need to look at options to minimize the effects of drought on fish and wildlife. The fishing restrictions that happened this year were significant, but also a number of fish mortality issues in different parts of Western Oregon in particular. And what are things the state can do going forward on that? Identifying data and resources needed to anticipate drought and its impacts on the economy, communities, and environment. And then improvements in data sharing will help the public, water users, and recreationalists better understand the impacts of drought and what things they can do to assist or mitigate and adapt to drought going forward. So a number of things that are being looked at as we move toward the future. And then finally, Director Beiler earlier highlighted the important investment by the 2015 legislature in Oregon Water Resources Future. This investment is going to help communities understand and meet both in-stream and out-of-stream water needs. We look forward to working with you, the legislature, to build on this investment and improve Oregon's resiliency to drought. So thank you. And with that, we'll take any questions.
Questions?
Yeah, thank you. Tom, I know that when we look at water storage, obviously we all hope that snow is our primary storage, but we did have a robust discussion 3 years ago on storage, and the state of Washington has been far more innovative than Oregon in water storage. Have you looked at what programs and funding levels the state of Washington has implemented? And what has the department concluded is an analogous effort we could make in Oregon?
Mr. Chair, Representative McLean, yes, we've definitely not only been watching Washington, but we've been actively engaged with them. In fact, we're working to put together essentially an MOU between my agency and our counterpart on the Washington side that would commit us to some shared action around looking at water resources development. That's specific to the Columbia Basin. But it's a way for us to gain insights and to learn from their experience, which I think is a valuable lesson for us. State of Washington, in I think 2006-2008 timeframe, appropriated $200 million specifically to develop water supply in the Columbia Basin, and so they have a bit of a head start on us, both in terms of resources and time in engaging in that effort, so we definitely want to take advantage of those relationships and that experience to help inform our work as we move forward.
Yeah, follow up.
What are the most significant barriers for the private sector to partner with the state of Oregon when it comes to creating water storage projects?
Mr. Chair, Representative McLean, there's there's a lot there. I think there are a lot of regulatory hurdles, as you're well aware, both from depending on the type of project that you want to build. The notion of building a surface water storage reservoir, for example, on a stream, on channel, where there are perhaps listed species, listed salmon, is a very, very difficult prospect, and has many expenses associated with trying to move on that type of effort. I think that what we are seeing now are folks are looking at other options, off-channel storage, aquifer recharge as another option. All of these are technically complex, and so there is a great deal of expense associated with analyzing and assessing the viability of these types of projects, let alone finding the resources to actually build them. So it's a difficult prospect, and requires a lot of resolve to stick with it, a lot of upfront investment to make it happen. I know to the extent that the state can be an active partner, providing either through grants and loans, which I'm excited to be able to offer that as a tool for folks and communities around the state to help them have those initial analyses and initial conversations. I think that'll go a long way in helping to develop ideas that are viable and hopefully will be successful in the long run.
That's one comment on that committee. It seems somewhat absurd that if the point is to save these species by having more water in, that you make it's incredibly difficult to keep more water in. It's a little bit challenging to figure out how you're going to save fish if it's really hard to store water to keep good flows during the summer. Mr. Leader.
It seems, I think you're accurate, Tom, in describing the challenges that the private sector has. I've talked to numerous folks about the rejection of an option of working with the state because of the regulatory apparatus, which has become so lengthy and expensive, which hence creates the dysfunction of the state. On the one hand, we're saying, my God, our storage capability of our natural system with snow is diminishing, and if climate change projections are accurate, then it will further diminish. We need to concentrate on water supply. And then on the other hand, one would argue that the state of Oregon has made it increasingly more difficult to actually solve that problem. And so, in my opinion, we need to go big. We absolutely have to have a massive investment in water storage in this state, double down, triple down, 10 times the amount of funding. with a concerted revamp, almost a side channel, if you will, of the regulatory apparatus that gets us out of LUBA, gets us out of all sorts of agency involvement into one specific view of how we go proceed forward. Because unless we do that, my apprehension is that we're not going to actually make any movement, and we'll be back here again and again and again talking about the plight of the drought. We do have an opportunity before this gets worse to do something real. And diversion of winter flow is the answer, but I don't know if there is the will of our executive to do that. And until the executive branch decides to make that a goal of the state, then, you know, we're in this state of dysfunction. And for me, I would sure appreciate finding out who has actually made applications for storage, to actually find out who are these, you know, the next Steve Jobs of Oregon, if you will, when it comes to water storage, because I haven't met her or him yet. And it would sure be a godsend, because, you know, this will eventually impact Portland. Perhaps when it does, then the state's executive will focus. Until then, we wait.
More rhetorical, probably, than you're welcome to respond to that if you like. If not, we can move on to more questions. Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The maps that you show, particularly the there was one that was colored brown, suggested, and I think you testified, that there's nothing on the horizon that would suggest that these problems are going to get better, but in fact, perhaps by extension, even worse. If that's true, and to me, the drought that we experienced and are still experiencing, and the maps that you showed, defines a crisis. And we've talked about water storage, and while that's necessary and I think a critically important thing to do, I also think it's reactive. And in the face of a crisis that looks like it is exceedingly long-term and will be affecting virtually every facet of every Oregonian's life that we can imagine, irrigation, recreation, industry, on and on and on and on, drinking water, adequate water for threatened and endangered species, across the board, everything we can possibly imagine, and probably a lot that we haven't even thought about. When is it that we convene a crisis management group in this state to be proactive in trying to head off some of the problems that are inevitable and are facing us here over the long term?
Mr. Chair, Representative Witt, thank you for that. We feel and hope that we are moving in that direction. One of the things that, as you were making your statement, that dawned on me that I wanted to make sure that I emphasized with folks here is that there is a lot that's happening, and there's a lot that we can do. And while certainly storage, either groundwater or surface water storage, may be long-term solutions for many communities, there's a lot that communities can be doing and are doing around the state that are helping address their supply needs in the near term. And the resources that you've appropriated in recent years for these grants and loans are going to help in a more immediate way. More specifically, I'm talking about conservation and efficiency improvements. Central Oregon, for example, has gone a long way toward lining and piping many of the canal systems that distribute water in that area. That's created savings that have not only made the irrigation districts in those areas more efficient in their distribution of water to their patrons, but is also, thanks to one of the programs that the state has provided some protected water in stream to help benefit fish and water quality. So there are some great tools that we have in Oregon, but it's going to take resolve, it's going to take resources and time and energy at the state level, the local level, and within the water user community to really make good on those opportunities.
Follow-up, Representative Witt?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, I'll come back to
Thank you for that response, and I think it is important that we're doing a lot of things, but I also believe that as Oregonians, we have come to expect that, you know, every fall, every winter, we replenish all of our ground and subsurface water systems. I don't think that that's going to be true out into the future, at least not to the extent that we become accustomed to. And what I'm suggesting is, as a result, we need to undertake life changes in the state, both as individual Oregonians and as a state, and we need the state in a leadership role to begin to help us develop and map that map towards making those kinds of changes that are going to be absolutely critical. That's number one. Number two, it's been my experience over several decades now watching a public's reaction on an annual basis when we have very severe forest fire cycles. That's in the public's conscience perhaps for about 3 months. The half-life of that going into the following year, it's gone by the time we're into the next fire season. We haven't taken up the necessary steps to be able to mitigate the problems that we're facing in the state in a whole host of areas. And I would say that we need to get ahead of this curve. We need to convene a crisis management group where we bring together all of the state agencies to begin planning and to begin to make these kinds of changes that are going to be critical to our future in this state.
If I could respond, Representative Witt, Mr. Please. Chair. You're absolutely correct, and as I was listening to the exchanges here, I wanted to let you know both Representative McLean's comments about storage and your comments about the broader picture of what needs to be done for the state of Oregon to lead in solutions for the long term. It absolutely is right, and if it wasn't clear enough before, I wanted to just let you know the governor's office is committed to doing that. And there are discussions that are happening now and are going to continue going into 2016, and certainly want to engage the legislative body in that, in terms of what can we do to best position Oregon to meet these challenges, because they are significant, and there are things we can do more of. I think what your investment was a good start, but more is going to be needed. And in particular, your comment about the public attention is really important, because we do need the public to engage in helping with solutions. And I think that's part of the place-based planning that the Water Resources Department is going to undertake. But that's funding for pilot programs only. So again, how do we do this on the bigger scale is an important question.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. And I don't mean to place the entire focus on you all, but quite frankly, you're convenient here at this point, but we need to begin to have this discussion, and I just see this as critical, and we cannot allow it to get any worse than it already is before we begin this process. So thank you for your willingness to undertake this.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to add to what Representative McLean and Representative Widow, the only thing that I want to add is, and maybe, and I apologize that I had to step out for a moment, maybe you already addressed this, but I don't ever want to reinvent the wheel. So since we have other states in the U.S. that have already experienced this far beyond where we are even, do we have models, do we have a plan that perhaps they've already written that we could just flow with, if that makes sense? I'm thinking California, obviously, Texas, perhaps others, and maybe glean from that and learn from that, or are you already doing that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Post, we are already doing that, but I'll tell you, quite frankly, the reality is that those other states that are actually taking action and making things happen are putting millions, if not billions, of dollars into of resources in to make those things happen. They are. This is not an inexpensive effort at all, but it can be done. But it really takes a significant commitment of time and resources, both human resources as well as funding.
Representative McLean.
One thing, Tom. This idea that a threat of like the Go Big plan. Is anyone working on that? Let's say we had $1 billion. How would we spend it? In other words, I think what I would love to convey is I think there are many legislators who understand the seriousness of this, and we believe it should be a higher priority with the executive branch. And perhaps we could work in conjunction on a Go Big plan. I think Chair or Representative Witt, who's our ag chair, is speaking boldly from his perspective and from agriculture that this is a crisis. And I'm not criticizing what the Water Resources Department is doing, because I'm very grateful for the advocacy of you and Governor Brown in the last session to fund what we did. I want to see projects done, and I just don't think we're going to get there unless we have unity of purpose. And so maybe a Go Big plan would be, how much does it really take? And what revisions of our regulatory apparatus would be necessary to achieve that result consistent with the other values that we have, knowing that obviously there's times where we have conflict and objects. But are we doing that? Can we do that? It would sure be great.
Mr. Chair, Representative McLean, I appreciate your vision on this, and I would say that the wheels are in motion and we're starting down that path, but we're not in the same place that California is or many of the other states in the Southwest, where they've been dealing with drought on a lot longer term than the state of Oregon has. So we're really at the very early stages, which is in part why we have these place-based planning grants, where we're really trying to invest in starting these discussions with communities. I think one of the strengths that Oregon has is that we've got a really fantastic foundation of collaboration among our stakeholders and basins across the state. And I think that gives me a lot of optimism about what we can do. But we are, I think we need to be careful that we not have expectations that we can turn projects around very quickly, because it will take some time, both in terms of the planning and building support within the community, as well as the technical aspects of making it happen. But so we'd be happy to engage with you and others in further conversations around what that might look like and how we can set ourselves up for the vision that you're talking about.
Thank you.
Representative Wood.
Just as kind of a to provide us some kind of frame of reference here going forward, can you, on the basis of what precipitation is predicted out into the future, give us, for instance, Oregon's, the 45th parallel in Salem, we can expect precipitation that is the equivalent of, I don't know, someplace in Nevada or whatever it would be now in the future. I mean, I think bringing it down to this level begins to make it real for the general public that things are changing, and this is going to necessitate major change.
What, Mr. Chair, Representative Witt, I may ask Raquel to follow up and correct any misstatements that I make, but I think what we're going to have is maybe it won't be necessarily drier, but it's the temperature issue that is the key driver here, and how that affects, as you saw in some of the slides earlier, how that affects the hydrograph and the timing of when water moves through our system. Raquel, you want to maybe reiterate that?
Chair Clem and Representative Witt and members of the committee. Yes, and that's why this hydrograph that I was showing you earlier really is the key takeaway is this year, I think, was the most alarming to us that we've seen during drought because it replicates what we've been hearing climate scientists say about the future in Oregon. So as you can see here, we had very low stream flows on this, the red being this year hydrograph, and we didn't get that typical influx of, you know, snowpack melting off. If you look at precip for the year, it wasn't a lot below normal. It was still below normal, but as I noted in the slides, if we go back to this is the October to December. If you look at the precipitation ranks, we were at about normal or above average, and and this would be a time where you would expect snowpack to start to form. But snowpack didn't form because it was so hot. Mm-hmm. And that's why we saw this kind of flashy system again, where that precip that we did get didn't fall as snow, it fell as rain. So temperature for us is really the big concern at the moment. And the climate predictions are that it's either warmer or a lot warmer. But in terms of precip, it could be wetter, it could be drier, it could be about the same. So there's less certainty around that.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, I just, before we let you go, share my thoughts on this topic. I got water added into my committee assignment. Not necessarily by my request, but I'm happy to try and take on a new challenge. I started my freshman year not knowing exactly what the state's water policy was, but I remember when I first got elected, the Statesman Journal editorial board asked me about, you know, what I thought the long-term problems for this state were, and I thought water was one, and I thought for the country, the overspending on credit cards and consumer debt and leverage mortgages was the other one. And that one already has come home to roost a little bit. But water was the other one I was kind of worried about, but I didn't know what to do. So there were some proposals made for Eastern Oregon, Umatilla Basin in particular, that session. And I got in trouble for voting across party lines on a motion to withdraw a bill out of a committee I was sitting in right in the middle of the hearing and lost a key program I wanted somewhere in the Ways and Means process right after that vote, I noticed. So then I decided I better engage a little more constructively and spent some time working with some groups in Umatilla to try and come up with some collaborative project to figure it out versus only trying legislative action to get attention to, I think it was called the OASIS Project, was the original attention-getting maneuver. And then my good friend Jefferson Smith got elected, and I somehow convinced him to get involved in this project. We had a large work group with Representative Jensen and Smith for a long time and came up with a project that did water bonding that nobody used, from what I understand. So then we tried to make some changes to that to make it more useful so people would do it. And I guess I see a lot of solutions that are probably out there, but a lot of them take a lot of money, or a lot of them people view as win-lose instead of win-win. And so then one side or the other is fairly unhappy. You know, I've certainly listened to discussions recently about Nestle and how they can get so much water out, but the farmers in Eastern Oregon can't. I listened at my elk hunting camp to lots of people from California talk about what all they're doing, and some blaming agriculture and some blaming themselves for lack of conservation. So, Tom, I know your background comes from a more collaborative place, Lori as well. And so I'm looking forward to those kind of efforts in the water world as well, where, you know, maybe we put a bunch of money in, but we also keep back some money, like the way we do 1% for the arts. We keep back some percent for fish enhancement as well. So it's not coming at the expense of the borrower. It's coming from our appropriation first. So it's not my water and now you want to charge me for it. It's money that's already taken off the top for fish enhancement, something like that. But I do think it's now, actually, I think it's the biggest issue. It, not the consumer debt issue is largely okay for the moment because people can't borrow if they don't have that much money unless the credit card companies get going again on that. So I would say there's a lot of opportunity. I think we do have to think big. I think it's, you know, it's not just the executive branch. We have to appropriate the money, obviously, for you to spend, but we do need attention from the executive branch, and we need to respond with cash and some of these programs that are in place. But I also think there's a lot of cost-effective ways. You know, I've spent time with DSL last week on a ranch where they've figured out how to slow down water at a very, very low cost per mile, and that's refilling the aquifer, not spending billions of dollars or even millions of dollars per river mile, but more like $100,000 for 20 river miles of restoration. But they're being, you know, taken through the ringer on all kinds of regulatory issues to make sure everything's done right and by the book and blah, blah, blah. And I think they're trying to do the right thing. And I think DSL saw that, and we probably will have a better outcome going forward on how those two interact with each other. But there are cost-effective ways to do it, including conservation. You know, in the Hood River Valley, where our orchard is, there's been a lot of effort on closing pipe canals, if giving out free micro-emitting sprinklers, all kinds of things to try and help. Because we want to keep agriculture there viable and healthy, but we need to do our part as well and not just spew water off the old sprinklers like I may or may not have done a few times. So anyway, I'm hopeful that we can find some solutions that are win-win for people. It just takes a lot more work, obviously, and a lot more money. That's my two cents.
Can I ask one question?
Yeah, Vice Chair Helm.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In all this, I wonder where our federal counterparts are. It seems to me that talking about the financial crisis, right after we encountered that, we had this idea that we're going to throw a bunch of money into the economy to stimulate it. And I, on the water issues, have, in looking back, have felt like we missed an opportunity to take some of that money, federal money, and get it into water conservation projects, which are complicated and expensive at the time. And this idea of, you know, what would we do if we had $1 billion? You never know when that's going to happen again. So, with that thought in mind, where are our federal so-called partners in the mix of our problems in our state?
Mr. Chair, Representative Helm, it's interesting. Thank you for that question, because it's interesting looking back historically at the role of the federal government with respect to water supply, especially in the dry side of the state. They have some major fingerprints on communities. If you look at the in the Malheur area in the Ontario Basin, major water supply was developed there 80 plus years ago that has allowed that community to prosper and has been the key to agriculture and the backbone for that community. There are many other areas and basins of the state where the federal government has made significant investment to build infrastructure for water. We're, I think, and as you all probably know, we're in a different place now in terms of how the federal government interfaces, and I don't think we're certainly not in a the same kind of mindset or era where the federal government is going to make huge investments in water infrastructure, at least not at this time. That said, I know that there is some federal legislation led primarily by West Coast delegations in California around trying to bring some resources to bear in the arid West to help address water supply issues. I don't know that that has good chances in the near term, but it's good that those conversations are happening. Our federal partners are at the table. They're talking with us, but they don't have the same resources that they have had in the past. Of course, the flip side of this is that we have other federal partners out there who have other responsibilities, whether it's Fish and Wildlife Service or NOAA Fisheries. They're also at the table, and they're important for us to be talking with as well because of the challenges in terms of being able to address water supply needs while not diminishing habitat and other key resources that are important from a federal standpoint as well. So I'm encouraged by the federal agency's willingness to engage, but I think that and we'll need to continue to do that. But in terms of the resources that we've seen many decades ago, I'm not holding my breath that we'll see a reinvestment anytime soon at that level.
Okay, we got to move on to our costs of doing business in rural Oregon, challenges and costs, which probably include water as well. And thank you for coming and joining us today. And with that, I will ask, we're going to get a phone call going. And then just start right down the list. Mark Long, Heather Stafford, and John Audley.
Petrified.
Mr. Farr? Perfect. Thank you very much.
Victor.
We're just getting started, so thank you for your patience.
I'm good.
Thank you for allowing me to do this by phone.
You can just go ahead and put your phone on mute, and then Representative Clem will say your name when it's your turn to talk. Thank you.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, so Mark, you're starting. Is that right?
Sure.
If you want.
Yeah.
Well, you've got a good story, and we have at least a partial solution already. So let's start positive. But
all right. Get started. Let me just make sure I've got the. Okay. For the record, my name is Mark Long. I'm an administrator of State Building Codes. What I'm going to do is kind of walk you through some of the things we've done over the last. Several years at Building Codes to really look at regulatory streamlining and then specifically addressing some of the challenges in Eastern Oregon. So how are we moving forward here? So just to start off, we went out and listened, starting back, our work really started back in 2003 with the Regulatory Streamlining Initiative under Governor Kulongoski, and then there was a report that I'm going to reference here that came out from the American Institute of Architects and PricewaterhouseCoopers that really kind of put it in front of us why we needed to make changes in our regulatory structure, and then I'll walk you through some things that we did. So, obviously, in Eastern Oregon, in remote parts of the state, recruiting staff is difficult, both on the private side and on the government side. Folks are leaving those communities. I think this committee is well aware of that. And keeping qualified folks, whether it's on the contractor side, developer side, or regulatory side, is very difficult. Our travel distances decrease efficiency. I think we're all aware of that, which raises costs. We have a reduced construction season over there. We're starting to wind down in many parts of the state, so that compresses everything and makes it really important to make sure your regulatory systems are timely and efficient in these areas where you have these additional impacts that you may not experience here in the valley. And then, of course, just costly delays. So I've pulled some excerpts from the report that I just mentioned where this really kind of hit home at our organization. We spent time before the recession to try to get both our organization and our local government partners up to speed on what really are the challenges, and if you could just change a few things, how that could change the dynamic between folks making go and no-go decisions on construction. So I'm not going to read these verbatim, but you can kind of see the pieces. And again, this comes out of a Accelerating the Permit Processes report that I could make available to the committee if you're interested, that came out in 2005. Some of the tax policy issues and finance issues have changed over time, but the core themes of if you can increase the or decrease the permitting time, accelerate the construction time, it's both good for the government side because it increases taxes as well as for the private side. You can see this. It was interesting, I hadn't remembered this when I was preparing for this committee, but for every 10 construction jobs, there's 8 others created locally that support those efforts while that's occurring. And we sometimes forget about the downstream impact of this activity. And then, obviously, can help the communities promote economic development. So more specifically, what we did is we began to integrate all of our services. We started, again, back in 2003, 2005. What this is attempting to represent is we put the process of adopting regulations. We adopt codes statewide for all the 130 city and county communities. We made sure that we now train the local government folks so we can align with our policy objectives. That's new in 2013. We have advanced dispute resolution, so we can have timely appeals if there's a difference. There are customer choices where folks can come to the state. We've put in different regulatory options so that you can get alternate methods of construction or emerging technology approved very timely, kind of your regular process. And then we've created this separate umbrella process for folks to advance through the system. And we put that all into our organization and tried to carry that out through our various partners. But it's very important that we have legislative support. So in kind of looking at our framework, we noticed that we had policy direction to make sure that we paid attention to energy issues and accessibility issues, but no policy direction on making sure that rural and remote parts of the state were focused on by when we set regulations and how we provide customer service. So this occurred in 2013 through Senate Bill 582, and I'll talk about that here in a little bit. But I can't emphasize enough how helpful just this simple policy directive from you to me helped me change not only the culture within the organization, but as we communicate, again, with those 130 different building departments. One of the things that we did, is, as I mentioned, is we brought in training for our local inspectors. Historically, that had been done out on the marketplace and at the local level. And one thing that you did for us in 2013 is allowed us to customize the training programs and make them community specific. And I know that sounds like kind of a small issue, but when you're in Eastern Oregon and you're just talking about water, I'll just give you a simple example. Getting farmers up and running in the springtime on their pivots and pumps is really important. They need to get going if they have water. And before 2013, you had to send a fully certified A-level inspector out to look at that. Well, we've created custom programs to where we took retired folks in communities, trained them up on how to go look at pivots and pumps so that we could get those things turned on quite quickly in the community. And so we're able to, community by community, region by region, customize our training to the needs of that particular community as opposed to before having a one-size-fits-all approach. Alternate regulatory options is very important if you're going to help rural areas. I know you know this, but there isn't a one-size-fits-all, and the risk profiles in the urban areas are different than in the rural areas. So first thing we did is we made sure the local officials had the ability to create alternate choices to the statewide policy that we adopt, that they can accept a different proposal from a community, and we gave that ability to them. Early recognition of national standards. What this does is allow customers who see something come out at the national level or international level and they want to try something different, we allow that to occur before it becomes a mandatory requirement here in Oregon. E-permitting is something that the legislature is familiar with. I've been working on this since 2003, and that's to speed up the timeline of construction through electronic systems. Right now we've got about 60 communities using a statewide system where we work to take money that we capture here, frankly, in Western and in the urban areas, and we provide services to the rural areas so that customers can apply, pay, and receive their building permits online and do transactions over the internet, reducing those travel times, those distances, and making it a little bit more efficient. Regional service delivery models. One of the things that this came out of the 2013 legislation, and again, it's a small thing, but I think you're all familiar with the fire that occurred over in John Day this last year. We were able to go in within a couple-week period and create a specific region with a different code standard just for those fire folks that are going to repair those homes, because we have a policy here that says you can repair to the standard that was in effect at the time of construction. We didn't know what that was, so we created something in a fast-track process that's unique to that area to allow those citizens to get back up and rebuild as soon as possible. And if it wasn't for your help and some of the changes that we've made, we would have been unable to do that.
Mark, on that point, one thought. I've talked about this, but I forgot to check into it. Is there any land use implications to rebuilding in any of these places to burn down homes?
Well, there are some. Excuse me, Mr. Chair. Yes, there are some, but we've been working with the other agencies, and frankly, I hope that the experience when we're done is you'll see that between our organization, LCDC, some of the other agencies over there, and DEQ have really kind of stepped forward to really kind of look at the broader picture. And you know, those folks were fine, and they weren't remodeling or rebuilding or tearing down or trying to build new things. A fire came through, and getting them back up and running kind of where they were before has been our focus here. And we were able to do that through our system within a very short period of time.
Great.
And I think that helped lead the way for the others.
Great.
You heard me mention I just want to kind of give you a picture. So we started our efforts again in 2003 with the Regulatory Streamlining Initiative, got going again, the report that I mentioned. Then we had the recession, kind of slowed things down. We got back and going again in 2013 with Senate Bill 582. And again, you put specific policy direction to us in that legislation. You created a statewide dispute resolution system so that there's timely appeal if a contractor's having a disagreement with a local official, or now if a local official isn't using one of those flexible tools that we've provided, you can come to the state and get kind of a relief valve so that that project can go forward. We put ready-built plans out on the website so things are kind of pre-done ahead of time. If you like what we've put out for you, you can go in and it's basically an over-the-counter type of approval, notwithstanding land use. And then the partnership model, which helped us with the John Day fire. We also now are moving to what we call additional customer choice options, and that is to make sure that we can review plans in local communities that may be burdened by losing staff. They may have long delays, and so we're able to go in and kind of help out right away and improve those turnaround times. Or in some cases, we're working with the business community where they're wanting to build in multiple areas, and there's kind of a master plan that you can put together that could be replicated in multiple communities. We help with that effort. Our rapid approval team for essential projects has been extremely helpful. We're working with CLT, the timber industry, moving some projects through there, and this allows customers to come to us and provide that overview to make sure that those essential projects can go through kind of timely. And then I guess just in summary, I think you all know this, and we recognize it, that time is critical. We've got to reduce the regulatory barriers through technology, our e-permitting. We're looking at video inspection and other tools, apps, phones, those kinds of things for our customers, flexible and customized services. You have to adapt very quickly. I tell folks stories, this is many years ago, when Portland General Electric came to us and said that they were going to be installing the first electric vehicle charging station in Oregon, and found out that there wasn't a permit system or a regulatory system for it. And they came to us and we asked, well, when are you going to be installing this? And they said, in a month. Okay. So we adopted regulations and rules through a piece of legislation that we had passed in 2005 on emerging technology to get standards written, permits issued within that 30-day period. And that's pretty quick in a regulatory environment. We're able to do that from some of the tools we put in place. And then the single point of access. That's kind of what we are. We're a one-stop shopping environment, and we worked very hard to kind of reduce duplication between what we do and maybe some of the other regulatory agencies. And again, this is especially important in rural Oregon, where you have that kind of reduced time frame to get construction done. You have all the distance barriers. You have a lack of staffing resources, lack of contractors. It's very important to make sure that you reduce those steps so that you can continue to support the efforts. With that, I'll be happy to take any questions.
Any questions for Mark? So one that I recall, and I don't remember exactly how that darn bill ended up as a Senate bill, because I thought we were working on it, but we had to use a vehicle from those critters over there.
Mr. Chair, if you notice, I referenced there were two House bills that had started over here, and then we used the Senate bill as the vehicle at the end of the day.
Oh, fine. Anyway, one of the things we talked about was the commercial building code fire standards, essentially by adopting national standards down to state standards to then rural Oregon. We ended up with some situations where there was like a requirement to build the system so a fire truck would come and pressurize the system and then help spray it, but in a rural area with a volunteer fire department an hour away, by the time it got there to pressurize it would already be burned down. So why would you have somebody build to that level when it's not even useful? And I think that's one of the kinds of things we tried to give you some flexibility to adapt, if appropriate, not harming public safety, but also not driving up costs.
Sure. Well, Mr. Chair, just to kind of give you the 30,000-foot view, as the standards are increasingly developed on the East Coast for kind of the urban areas, they forget about the western part of the United States. And it used to be several years ago, just a little building codes trivia, that there were three different standards bodies, one that was just for Western states, one that was for Southern states, and one for Eastern states. That all merged into one. They called it the International Code, and that's primarily driven, in my opinion, by some of the more urban areas. And so what we did is say, look, there's a difference when, as I mentioned, on the risk profile to your densely populated areas, to areas where you have not feet, but almost maybe miles of distance between structures, and what can we do? So you gave us authority to recognize those differences, which we've done. And the second thing that you did, and I talked about duplication of effort, is you made it clear that on the building code side, we make those fire calls, so that you didn't have the building inspector saying one thing and a fire inspector saying another thing. And so you kind of centralized that into one spot, allowed us to adjust the regulations, and so that's where you're seeing some of the relief occur in these remote areas. And we put together a task force to look at these and a whole bunch of other issues, and that works ongoing because of the policy direction that you gave us.
Now the committee sees why I wanted him to go first, because we have some real challenges, but in this particular case, I think we're doing pretty well. But we can always look for more ways to do better, of course.
There's always work to do, and I guess just what I'll share with you, the work that you've done has been very helpful. What I have found over my years is, as the economy goes down, we tend to focus on the issues, and then when it gets real, when the economy gets better, we tend not to. And I think these things are things that we should be working on all the time, constant process improvement, looking at new technology, and making sure that we're meeting, recognizing the unique needs of rural and remote parts of the state. So that's just my take on it.
Good point. Yeah, that's true. We have a lot of money to spend sometimes. Like, oh, that's fine. When it's tight, like, no, wait, why?
Yeah.
And you're right. We should not waste money no matter what.
Well, in my world, notwithstanding the last recession, we go through construction booms and busts in our communities about every 3 to 5 years. And so as we ramp up, we're kind of focusing on different things than when it's ramping down. And I think that we should be paying attention to this kind of all the time. I think it would make it a better system.
Yeah. Okay. I don't remember if I interrupted or you were basically done for that moment.
I'm okay. Here for whatever you need,
okay,
Mr. Chair.
Let's keep going. Thanks. I've got Heather next, but or am I supposed to?
Nope.
Okay, Heather?
Great. Chair Clem and members of the committee, my name is Heather Stafford. I'm the Assistant Director of Innovation and Entrepreneurship at Business Oregon. This is an office that has existed for since April of this year, and came out of a real intensive look around the state at communities. It was sort of a listening tour. Sean Robbins, our previous director, went around the state and included many, many rural communities and listened to what their needs were, and overwhelmingly heard innovation and entrepreneurship as one of those that needed very direct and more focused support from the state level. So I think my team is the result of that journey, and we've done a lot of amazing things. We've got some tools that you're all familiar with, that we also, policy options that we manage, like Oregon Innovation Council and the Oregon Metals Initiative, Collaboratory for Sustainable Manufacturing, partnerships with research institutes to further metals research, and RAIN, the Regional Accelerator and Innovation Network in the South Willamette Valley. And we've brought all those in and looked at what a real strategy means, I think, for the entire state. And a lot of times innovation can get confused with tech, and can get confused with angel capital and unicorns and all these various hit words. And so I just wanted, I think this, what I'm here to present to you today is a test at a solution to have an inclusive entrepreneurship solution for the entire state that includes rural. Oregon Inc. represents, and the Signature Research Centers represent, a cluster building strategy, so focusing on, you know, various specific industries where we know that Oregon has a strength, where we've got a great talent pool, or our universities are able to do this. Testing out new industry initiatives through things like Oregon Storyboard and Oregon Wave Energy Trust and Drive Oregon, various solutions like that help us prove out new industries. But where we recognized a real gap, and knowing that more than 70% of new jobs are coming from people and companies who already call Oregon home, a grow our own strategy is really what our entire agency is focused around. And this is all that's ever really been available to rural Oregon, as most people know. We, as a state, don't stack up very well on incentives compared to other states as well, so trying to sort of catch big game and get them to come and move into the state and bring all their jobs with them has been less successful for us. So a grow-our-own strategy just makes a lot of sense, but what does the infrastructure look like to be able to do that around the state effectively? So what we decided, you know, what we recognized on a regional capacity-building level, that the only tool in our toolkit that we really had that was built out was RAIN. And for their efforts and putting forward the work that they've done over the last 4 years, it's not enough to just do one part of the state, that there's really a lot more opportunity out there, and innovation can really happen anywhere. So where do we find those innovators that are in their garage? How can we find those inventors, entrepreneurs, and what does success look like? You know, 5 jobs, 10 jobs in a rural community is very, very meaningful. And the path to commercialization is different. And what kinds of tools can we ourselves innovate to better prepare the state to grow our own? So this is an outcropping of that. It's called the Rural Entrepreneurship Development Capacity Building Grant. It's a $250,000 total pool. It's announced just today, so you caught it on the very first day it's being announced. You have a copy of it in front of you. But I just want to take a little short walk through and then open it up to questions for you. So in our definition, what we're really looking for in these grants, and we left it very open on purpose because we're hoping to inspire some creativity, and we know there's a lot of great work being done already out in rural parts of the state that is, I would say, under-supported. And so we want to gather up all that talent out there and see what we can pull together and put some catalytic money into it and then see what we can do for full-on regional capacity building in 2017. So the outcomes we hope that we'll find are establishing coordinating mentorship assistance. This could be used to identify and access venture or angel investors in various communities, put together seed funds. Could be used for coaching, other assistance to refine and sharpen presentations to potential investors, or to plug into the Oregon Inc. infrastructure or the university infrastructure that's already existing in the state. And it could be used for classes to start from scratch and find new entrepreneurs, find a way to communicate with them. And then just connecting them with professional expertise, coaches, technical assistance, licensing. It can take on a variety of forms. We really want these rural communities to own who they are. I think we'll find less success in trying to take a rubber stamp and use our urban model and try and stamp it on a rural community and hope that that will work for incubation and acceleration. We really want to have communities own these projects themselves. So in our definition, an entrepreneur will have less than 10 employees, will have been in business less than 2 years, manufactures a product that adds value to a natural resource, produces a product that has the potential to be in a market where there is national or international competition. So that's what you hear traded sector referred to often, but it's not limited to traded sector because we know baby companies aren't traded sector right off the bat. But if they have the potential to grow into and the interest to grow into traded sector, that's certainly a criteria. And then in this definition, rural means that it's a county not within one of the statistical MSAs, which we now have 8. If it is within one of the statistical MSAs, but it must be outside an urban area with a population of 30,000 or more. So it really is to get after those really underserved communities that and see what they can make of growing their own companies. And at that, I suppose you have this in front of you and you can read it at your leisure, but I'm happy to field any questions.
Any questions? So post Sean's departure, same focus?
Same focus, absolutely. Yeah, the whole infrastructure now is built around this grow our own strategy.
That's great. Do we even have our Economic Gardening Council anymore? Or do we lose it in the last session?
Great to have one.
We had one. It's called GROW. I'm on it. I'm not on it. GROW. What's it called? I'll Google it. Why don't you finish?
Perhaps it's the Oregon Growth Board?
Mm-hmm. I'll look it up while you're telling us about your program.
Well, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Audley. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Business Council, the Oregon Business Plan, and its annual summit. This year will take place December 14th in Portland. We urge you all to come join us. My testimony is also informed by another client of mine, Craft 3, a nonprofit financial institution specializing in loans to entrepreneurs, nonprofits, individuals, and others who don't have access to traditional forms of financing. Let me begin first by thanking Mark and his team for being so creative with the manufactured wood cross-laminated timber community. This is an emerging part of Oregon's 21st century approach to wood fiber and its uses. It's not easy to make this transition. These will be important buildings for Portland and the nation, if not the world. And I tip my hat to Mark's team for bringing the approach of how do we figure this out as opposed to how do we not do this. I'd also like to thank Heather and her team. My written testimony reflects the history of the Oregon Business Plan, the Oregon Business Council, and its efforts to strengthen its interest support for rural economic development priorities. For about 5 years, the Oregon Business Council, Oregon Business Plan, has emphasized forest sector and water as its two high natural resource priorities. And we thank the legislature for taking important steps towards accelerating pace and scale of forest health restoration, forest infrastructure recreation, if you will, and also water storage in legislation last year. But in 2014, recognizing that, to paraphrase a friend, these look like ornaments on a tree, not a comprehensive approach to a rural economic development strategy. In partnership with the Oregon Business Council and Regional Solutions, we co-hosted those 12 listening sessions with Sean and his team. I commend the report that I've included in my formal testimony and the link to the entire report as a way to underscore our desire to listen more and then reflect those priorities in the development of the Oregon Business Plan. Heather's done a good job of emphasizing a couple of the themes that grew out of the 2014 listening session, so I won't dwell on the important aspects of growing your own economic framework, which is great to see an actual response to that input. Also, greater exposure and coordination of innovation and entrepreneurial resources. Again, you can see Business Oregon stepping into that space. But among the other themes that were reflected in the listening sessions, a focus on retention, growth of existing businesses and expansion efforts, enhanced coordination on infrastructure development, and infrastructure by my way of thinking, is very broadly defined. It includes both roads and bridges, which are oftentimes missing or insufficiently maintained in our rural communities, but also the infrastructure associated with housing, growing communities of folks who are working in rural communities. It could include broadband. And making sure that our rural communities have access to high-speed internet. So when you think about infrastructure, or we think about infrastructure, we think about it broadly. And better coordination of financing and the opportunities to access resources, the financial resources that may be difficult for distance or time or the cumbersome aspects of dealing with agencies, both federal and state, so that business people and consumers can better access money smart, fast, and efficient. I'd say to support one of the comments that has been a repeated theme this morning and one that the chair experienced on his recent trip out to the other side of the state and a visit to a ranch that I know fairly well. One of the things that we're looking for or wrestling with is how to focus regulation on the outcome of the regulatory objective, not the process of the regulatory process itself. I think that has been a recurring theme that we've heard. Get away from this, these are the steps you must take, and I'm not trying to diminish the steps themselves, but what is the outcome that we're trying to achieve, and how do you create flexibility both for the individual, the business, the landowner to achieve that outcome, but also the regulatory agencies whose job it is to enforce the law and then report back to you all. I think these are important themes that will be reflected in the upcoming summit agenda, and it is our goal in 2016 to repeat the listening session with our partners on the ground throughout the state as we take additional steps to deepen the business plan and Summit's commitment to supporting the goals of our rural communities. I think it's important to recognize that the Summit and the business plan and the policy playbook are tools that we want to see, we hope to see rural communities invest more time and energy because they themselves feel that those tools are valuable to them. If that's going to happen, then we have to make sure that they're valuable to them, and that's why the Oregon Business Council hired me to give them a hand. So I thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today, and I'm happy to answer your questions.
So I think Representative Gomberg, then I'll come
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. You touched on the availability of services like broadband and making sure those are available in a variety of rural communities, and I appreciate that, but I feel compelled to add to that that it's not just a matter of availability, it's also a matter of the fragility of those services. So often we've got one line in, one line out. Somebody sticks a shovel in the ground in Tualatin and the internet goes down across the entire Central Coast, and losing the internet on the Central Coast isn't a matter of not accessing Facebook or YouTube. It means you can't run credit cards, you can't take hotel reservations, you can't ship a package. And we've got a consistent problem there, whether it be broadband, whether it be electric service, whether it be telephone service. Redundancy is a major part of the conversation if we're going to talk about a service that's available throughout the state.
Chair Clem, Representative Gomberg, I agree with you entirely. My personal opinion is that broadband will be our version of the Tennessee Valley Authority. We need to make sure that rural communities have access to this kind of technology, both in the direct line to you and your home and your businesses, but also the redundancy to make sure that if that you have an interruption in service. It takes time. I don't want to get ahead of the Oregon business plan process. What I've learned in the time I've spent working on rural economic development issues is we have to be very careful to listen to the priorities of the people who live in these communities and respond to them first. And that's why the listening sessions are so important and why we'll do it again in 2016.
Yeah, one comment about broadband. My stepbrother was, he went to Oregon State, and the three of us, my brother, my stepbrother, and I all do IT work professionally. And I'm here, obviously, and have an IT consulting business. My biological brother's at Microsoft in Bellevue. But my stepbrother was able to eventually go back to Coos Bay once broadband came. And he works for a global firm called Husky that makes, I think, water bottle plastic injection molding machines. And they've been bought up. This company's been bought like five times by different companies. But once they said you can get broadband in Coos Bay, fine, you can go there. And he makes good money, and he works out of his garage in slippers. And he flies out of the Coos Bay Airport to Eugene and then to Belgium or wherever to support the infrastructure. But, you know, he wanted to go home. It's just no company was going to let him go there till he could remotely telecommute appropriately. And this was maybe 10 years ago when they finally got it good enough and solid enough, in Coos Bay at least, so he could do that. But it's been great, you know, for him at least and his family. Representative McLean.
John, thank you for this. It's helpful. Our previous governor, John Kitzhaber, had emphasized the work of the Oregon Business Plan that's done by the Oregon Business Council and others. Do you, and tried to, at least from my understanding, parts of it were incorporated into his legislative agenda and goals for the agencies. How have the conversations with our new governor gone, and do you know if she's going to equally embrace your work and that of the Oregon Business Plan, or do we know if this is not necessarily going to be embraced by the executive branch as opposed
Mr.
to
Chair
a good
Leader,
idea?
Mr. Chair Leader McLean, you're batting above my pay grade. I'm a consultant to the Oregon Business Plan, so I don't interact directly with the governor's office. What I can tell from my distance is, as we have in the past, worked closely with previous governors, so we are with Governor Brown and her team. I'm also learning the culture of the Oregon Business Council and the Oregon Business Plan, and it's not as hardwired. It's a more arts creative approach to developing the agenda as we approach the summit date itself. I know the conversations are ongoing. I'm confident that that the governor's office will embrace a rural economic development agenda, as did Governor Kinsella.
I found what I was looking for. So back in 2011, we passed this bill, House Bill 2879, that Representative Smith and Jensen authored along with a lot of us, Bailey, Beyer, Buckley, Clem, Conger, Escoval, Gelser, Gilliam, Kenemer, Lindsay, Matthews, Nathanson, Sheehan, Smith, Thatcher, Thompson, Whitener. And it created the Economic Gardening, I think, task force that then became later, with more funding, the Grow Oregon Council, which when I just went to Business Oregon website, it's not there anymore. So I think it's gone. I think we maybe didn't fund it, which is okay as long as the whole agency's transformed into a Grow Oregon agency. Then it doesn't really matter whether our little pet project from 2011 survived or not. Actually, starting in 2010, it just didn't pass until 2011.
I think the Chair Clem and Council, I think the Grow Oregon initiatives have been taken over in large part by the Small Business Development Centers.
Yeah.
So it was an initiative that was certainly championed and sparked by us and still is. And if, you know, I think the Small Business Development Centers did ask for that again last session and were did receive some more funding.
Okay,
so
good.
In some capacity, it is still intact. Yes.
That's good. Yeah, we just want to make sure, obviously, that the state is still on board with that program, and not necessarily that. I don't care about the committee or that program, just the philosophy of growing your own. And I think it is wise to then help them tap into traded sector activities. I just got back from 2 weeks in China with several small companies, Oregon companies, who are, you know, increasing their revenues significantly by being able to tap global markets, but they had to get a little bigger first before they're willing to start even paying economy class to go over there and figure out how to navigate Asia.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, one comment that came to me as I was listening to this conversation, that one of the themes that we'll emphasize in the upcoming summit is the crossover of interests between the quote-unquote urban business community and the rural business community. For example, infrastructure plays a critically important role for all businesses across the state, be it access to a port and shipping product downriver, or highways or rail. If the port of Portland's not functioning very well, it's very hard on an East Oregon farmer to get grain to market, because those markets are outside the United States in many instances. So one of the things that we're going to emphasize are the commonalities of priorities that exist from infrastructure and other issues that you'll see reflected in the summit. I think what we're in part trying to underscore is, yes, this is a big state, and for those who have driven around know and can appreciate just how big it is. We're a lot smaller in lots of ways, and we have a lot more in common. That if we emphasize that, maybe we can actually make more progress by bringing those perspectives to bear more effectively, with all due respect to decision makers such as yourself.
Can I chime on?
Just one more, then we'll move on. Yeah.
Okay. Chair Clement Committee, I just want to chime on to that a little bit with the collaborative effort. I forgot to mention that the Oregon Growth Board, which manages the Oregon Growth Account and the Growth Fund, will be acting as advisors to this. And so it's really creating that network and that connective tissue or that bridge between our venture investments as a state and trying to bring more capital into the state and growing entrepreneurs in all shapes and sizes and varieties that are attractive to those. As investments change, you know, rural entrepreneurs become actually incredibly more attractive offers.
That's great. Well, consider this committee a friend of yours. You know, a lot of the a lot of times the rural communities don't have Democrats don't have the best reputation in some of these communities, but we have some great rural Democrat down on one end and another one over in this end. And I'm not really Representative Helm, not so much probably, but we try to. So we have obviously our strong rural Republican members and one sort of weird river district member. He's got some serious farmland in there, but. So we
fertile
we
crescent of Oregon.
It's the fertile crescent of Oregon.
Wow.
Lord, mine's like this gerrymandered reverse Italy boot. That's what I call mine. So we would like to be of help. I think all of us are interested in this. Okay, let's get up. Marianne Nash, Lincoln, Link, Cannon, Mike Fries, and Jay Farr.
The representative from the
speaking of the Fertile Crescent. What can you Fertile Crescent? Can I use the restroom and you just take over for a little bit?
Absolutely.
Thanks,
where
Fertile Crescent.
So we've already heard this, so we don't need to reopen it. We just need to welcome Marianne Nash from the Oregon Farm Bureau.
Thank you. Vice Chair Post, members of the committee, my name is Marianne Nash, here today with the Oregon Farm Bureau. Thank you so much for the opportunity to testify on challenges of doing business in rural Oregon from the agricultural perspective. So I prepared a little slideshow to help hopefully entertain as we go through this. As you all know, agriculture is a really important part of the economy in Oregon. About 12% of all Oregon jobs are connected directly or indirectly to farming and ranching. About 80% of our agricultural production in Oregon leaves the state, and about 40% of that is exported internationally. And so we really do play a major role in Oregon's economy, second largest industry in Oregon, and almost exclusively in rural economies. So as you are aware, Oregon has a very diverse agricultural base. We have about 225 recognized commodities in the state. One thing I'll say, pausing on this picture for a moment, is I'm talking about some broad-based challenges throughout the rest of this presentation, but I've spent, by and large, the better part of the last month traveling throughout going to our rural farm bureaus all over the state, primarily in eastern Oregon and along the coast. And I'd say that our issues are also very regional in terms of what specific challenges folks are facing, largely regulatory challenges, but very regional. So I'll try to talk a little bit about some specific examples of that as I go through. One of the biggest impacts in the last year has been transportation challenges. Among those, the port shut down. We lost about 98% of container traffic at PDX. Most of that traffic is now moving by rail or by truck, and we lack the transportation infrastructure to really be able to move those goods to market effectively. That includes both what we consider more urban infrastructure, like the I-5 corridor, as well as rural roads, and rural road maintenance has been a real issue in terms of making sure that people can effectively get their product to market without major congestion or shipping hurdles. And then obviously the cost of fuels greatly impacts production, both through transportation, getting goods to market, and actual production in terms of cost of fuels to run equipment that's necessary for harvest and production. Another really big issue, particularly among the orchard and berry sector, our labor and workforce issues. So there's been labor shortages over the last several years. A major cause of that is immigration hurdles, obviously, and challenges in getting qualified workers. It's funny because my Tim Bernasek, who you guys I think know well, always talks about people say, you know, agriculture is quote unquote an unskilled workforce, but the skill involved in harvest, and particularly berry and orchard harvest, is considerable. And so getting folks that are qualified and able to do that work has been a real challenge. And then there's obviously just cost of workforce is increasing. We're competing more with other sectors for the same labor force. And then one of the big pieces is cost of compliance. As we've seen a lot of the new initiatives in terms of paid sick leave, mandatory retirement, all of those come with a significant HR component. And most of our farmers are their own HR. Oftentimes they're considered joint employers with any farm labor contractors that they use, but they have their own responsibility to keep and maintain records, and the cost of figuring out just what those should look like and how to maintain them for workers, particularly with a large seasonal workforce, is a real significant issue, and one that I think is often overlooked when you typically think of companies as having an HR department. When we're talking about small rural businesses, they often are their own HR department. So that's been a real challenge. And then, again, with the seasonal workforce, a lot of the unique needs of agriculture have not been accounted for in many of the new mandates that we're dealing with. And so that's been a real challenge for folks in terms of figuring out how they're going to implement them when the system's not really designed to fit how their labor force works. And so I won't belabor this point too long, except to say that, as you heard earlier, drought has been and will continue to be a real challenge for agricultural production. From the actual production side, it results in earlier harvest, fewer rotations of crops, which directly, both of those directly impact a farmer's bottom line. And then, again, facing shorter irrigation seasons. And then the temperature increases and can cause damage to many of our more sensitive crops. And they will also continue to change crop choices and crop rotation. So agriculture is diverse in the state and pretty resilient, but it does start to alter the market as we see extended periods of drought, because folks can't grow what they used to grow, or they maybe have to make some pretty hard economic choices in terms of maybe going into a commodity that doesn't make as much but is less, you know, has a lesser water demand, or trying to just do more with less in terms of growing what they've traditionally grown. So it's been a big issue, and I think will continue to be an issue. And one of the things I'd add in here, too, is that we're also seeing an influx of agricultural land being purchased from out-of-state entities that are looking to grow or expand to grow some commodities that we've been seeing growing, particularly hazelnuts and blueberries. And again, that's in terms of water availability. Just something we've been keeping an eye on, because we're noting that it's water availability for traditional farmers in the state, but water availability issues elsewhere have been kind of changing the market for what we see in terms of purchasing agricultural land and who farmers are, particularly in the valley. So one of the big challenges we'll be facing in the coming year is in 2013, the Congress passed the Food Safety Management Act. It's actually, I think, Food Safety Modernization Act. This is an older slide. And one of the big challenges, we just saw the final produce rules released on Friday. And those are going to have a pretty significant impact, both in terms of water quality standards that are now applying to applications of fruit, and then just some changes that we tried to get in there, again, to recognize the unique diversity of commodities in Oregon, successful in some respects and not in others in terms of the final rulemaking. So it's going to be a big challenge for the Oregon Department of Agriculture and for Farm Bureau and for farmers throughout the state to figure out how to comply with this new federal mandate. One of the big outstanding questions is also whether or not imported food is going to be required to meet the same standards that we now have to meet here in the states with food that we produce. One of the other concerns that I know the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife joined us in expressing is the pretty significant wildlife management regulations under the new FSMA rules. We've always viewed ourselves as an excellent provider of wildlife habitat, and these management challenges in terms of keeping wildlife out of some of the crop areas are going to be a significant cost for farmers to figure out how to comply with that, and also a cost for management agencies in terms of figuring out, okay, if they had a traditional seasonal habitat that is now kind of regulated off because of FSMA, where do they go? And what does that look like? I won't belabor this point either because I'm sure you've heard plenty of it. We are very concerned about WOTUS. American Farm Bureau Federation is leading a nationwide effort to curtail the implementation of the Waters of the United States rule. We view it as significantly expanding federal jurisdiction beyond what is authorized or allowed under the Commerce Clause, and it will require significant impact on farmers and ranchers, particularly as it's litigated through the court system, in terms of requiring permits and federal consultation for things that historically have not required them. So I think it'll be years down the road before we see these types of impacts, but they will be significant, and it's something that has most of our farmers and ranchers pretty terrified about the expansion of federal jurisdiction.
Marion, one second.
Yes.
Leader McLean.
One question.
Sorry.
Has the state of Oregon, if I recall, the state of Oregon took a position, correct?
Talked about that last time.
Yes, Chair Clem, Representative McLean, that is correct.
And the Attorney General, Ellen Rosenblum, without any authorization from, I understand, the governor's office and certainly from the legislature, took the position to support the Water of the United States regulatory expansion. And has there been any change since we raised that issue 3 months ago? Or is she still doubling down on federal expansion regulating Oregon farmers?
Chair Clem, Representative McLean, my understanding is that the state of Oregon has still, they moved to intervene at the Sixth Circuit, which is the consolidated circuit court case challenging the Waters of the United States rule. The state of Oregon joined several other states in that intervention. I understand that they are still staying strong in that. I have not heard of any change in position. The Sixth Circuit did issue that nationwide injunction, which will be pending until a jurisdictional question between the lower courts and the circuit courts is decided. It's unclear which court system should actually have jurisdiction over the challenge. But my understanding is the state of Oregon has maintained its position, and that's been my understanding through conversations I've had with those involved.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It would be great if the Attorney General would tell us why she has done this, what authority she did it under, and if it's such a significant negative impact on our second most important industry of the state. This is the second time now in the fall season that we've asked for this explanation, and yet we haven't heard anything from the Attorney General.
Yeah, maybe we can write a letter.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Wynn.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Marianne, can you tell me under what authority the EPA presumes to regulate these somewhat less than navigable waters?
Yes, Chair Clem, Representative Witt. I'll try not to go too far back, but authority to the Clean Water Act authority essentially stems from the Commerce Clause. Mm-hmm. And there were two cases I think we've talked about, the Swank case and the Rapanos case, that essentially were questions about how the extent to which the Army Corps of Engineers and EPA can regulate wetlands and other kind of ephemeral water bodies. Mm-hmm. And this rulemaking was allegedly an attempt to create a rulemaking after the Rapanos decision that would help provide clarity about what the court had decided. But those of us who followed the Swank and Rapanos case in this rulemaking think that it went far beyond what the Rapanos court, it was a plurality decision, but what the Rapanos court upheld and Justice Kennedy's concurrence, which is kind of the lead opinion on Clean Water Act jurisdiction after Rapanos. And so they went far beyond what Rapanos said, but it was an attempt to clarify jurisdiction after the Rapanos and Swank cases.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I don't even presume to begin to know any of these arguments, but I just find it interesting that arguments in favor of regulatory authority based on the navigation of a dry creek bed stretches credibility with me.
Well, so you could kind of navigate around a few rocks, and, like up over a dry tree limb. And if you're a fish and you had legs, you could jump over it. That's what I'm thinking. No? Okay, then. You know, if I recall, Richard talked about a little bit his perspective, Richard Whitman, which was there were some things we really do need to be alarmed about. I think he used slightly less alarming language, but he said there's one issue we're particularly worried about, and I can't remember what it was. And then we talked about the private standing or standing to sue kind of issue. You know, his position, I think, was that there was also some clear lines that would make people not have to go, and somehow those balanced out, like the times you would not have to go into these kind of determinations balanced out the others. I didn't gather that you agreed entirely with that, but I think it would be helpful probably to get the DOJ, as Leader McLean talked about, the DOJ answer as well to go with what Richard talked about. I think he's quite knowledgeable about it, but it'd be nice to know why DOJ intervened as well.
And, Chair Clem, I just make the offer to get American Farm Bureau has been incredibly involved in the litigation, and we have access to their briefs and their information and a very detailed explanation of how we think this could negatively impact agriculture. And it's not EPA's present interpretation that scares us. It's the ability for environmental groups to sue over what the actual plain language of the rule says and to say, well, no, actually, you should be requiring a permit for all harvest, all deep tilling and all fertilizer and pesticide applications because we view that entire field as a water of the United States. And that's particularly troubling for us given how wet a lot of the valley and coastal regions are. And so I can get you any information you want and be happy to supply whatever information I can to be helpful.
That's a good point because we talked about puddles on logging roads and that issue supposedly got clarified, but puddle in the middle of my orchard, maybe not so much.
Right. Yeah.
Jesus. Okay. Sorry, those are nightmares now. Thank you. Let's move on.
So, yes.
Oh, Endangered Species Act.
Endangered
Species
Act. That's
another great one. Okay.
And this is one of those issues that's easy to. It's a statewide issue. There's an endangered species concern in almost every region of the state right now, but it really impacts and areas of concern vary by the state. The coastal regions and a lot of the valley will be impacted by this potential FEMA consultation. We're expecting a biological opinion any day now. We'll require counties to adopt ordinances around regulating development in floodplains. Sage grouse, obviously, a southeastern Oregon issue. The decision not to list was made, but we're still dealing with the impacts of federal resource management plan amendments and changes to state law governing development. Streaked horned lark will be a valley issue. There's a notice of intent to sue regarding an agricultural exemption for streaked horned larks in the Willamette Valley.
What's a streaked horned lark?
It's a tiny little bird that looks kind of like a killdeer, and it actually does have little feather horns.
Are they streaked?
They are. They're yellow streaked, yellow and black. And so that's something that we've been interacting with Fish and Wildlife Service on to figure out how agriculture can be helpful and make sure that that habitat needs are being met while still protecting agriculture and agricultural.
Is there another lark that kills it, like the owl's killing the other owl?
No, they're
shotgun the one owl.
the main threat to the streaked horned lark is they like disturbed habitats. They live on port dredge sites, and they used to live in Willamette grasslands, and so they like some types of cultivated fields. And so they've just been, as development has occurred and there's less dredging and less cultivation, there's several other predatory and other impacts on them, but that's the habitat impact they're trying to address. And then spotted frog, relating back to water supply availability, I get probably 5 calls a week from farmers and ranchers in Central Oregon that are terrified about the impacts of water curtailments because of this notice intent to sue for the spotted frog in Central Oregon. So I'd say in Oregon, the water supply and water availability issues are intimately connected to the endangered species issues. And the Endangered Species Act has been used as a tool whenever folks don't like, particularly, you know, a lot of them have been collaborative management agreements that have been reached, but the ESA can still be used as a tool to come in and lobby side attacks on those agreements. And that's really what happened with the spotted frog. And
Leader
really
McLean looks excited about the spotted frog.
I'm
it's kind of like my spotted owl feelings, I think.
this really... colleagues will be something we're going to hear about. I think the tactic that Mary Ann mentioned, certainly produces some suspicion that shutting down or significantly reducing irrigation in Central Oregon is not
an end game, potentially.
It's an end game, as opposed to the welfare of the spotted frog. But I don't know enough about, I haven't read the reports as to the impacts on the spotted frog. But I do, I have a lot of constituents who have contacted me over the intent to sue. So Farm Bureau has taken a position, correct? And has the state of Oregon taken any position in the spotted frog adversarial proceeding that's upon us?
So, Chair Clem, Representative McLean, right now there's two notices of intent to sue under the Endangered Species Act that are pending, one getting at the Bureau of Reclamation for its operations, and the second also seeking to pull in the irrigation districts under a private take allegation. Oregon Farm Bureau has been working closely with the irrigation districts and our impacted farmers to participate and be helpful. There's not a lawsuit filed yet that we could get involved in. I know that the state has, I think, been made aware of and involved in some of the conversations, but I think right now work is still ongoing with the private irrigation districts to develop a habitat conservation plan and essentially move forward with the collaborative approach that they were working under, working with Fish and Wildlife and others. To develop a management plan that will both protect the spotted frog and allow irrigation to continue. So I haven't talked to the state about whether and to what extent they will take a position once the litigation is filed. But I do know that there's still been a lot of work ongoing to kind of move forward with the original efforts that had been progressing before groups came in and kind of did an attack from the side.
Yeah. Okay, we got to move on. Sorry.
That was it.
Yeah, great. Nice. We're,
I know.
Just 15 seconds.
Okay,
go.
Marianne, thank you. Marianne, I wrote this down from the beginning because we heard from water this morning. We've heard a lot of things, and it seems to be coming back to that. So, Marianne, I don't know that you can answer this necessarily in your opinion. And this is why, because I'm a great listener, because I do represent the Fertile Crescent of Oregon. What is, in your estimation, the largest challenge or most pressing of all the things that you've mentioned today with farmers in Oregon? Or is there one?
20 seconds or less. Go.
I know.
Chair Clem, Representative Post, I don't think we can, as I said, for each region and each farmer, it's different. Some, you know, labor, if we don't solve labor problems, they're going to be out of business. Others, if we can't figure out the spotted frog issue, their farm's going to not have water available and they're going to go bankrupt. If we're talking about, you know, some of the coastal regions, the removal fill issues are really concerning to them. Endangered species issues, coastal coho recovery plan, all of those things are really top of mind for them. So I think it is regional, depends on the farmer, and all of these things combined are making it just really difficult for folks to make a living in agriculture in Oregon presently.
So the need for people like me to understand these things and not just make laws without understanding them, that's what you're saying?
Yes.
Oh, great. Okay, Link.
With water, it seems like. Water seems to be the common theme that I keep hearing.
Water's a big deal.
Okay.
Okay, 3 minutes each. Now that I ruined everybody else's time, sorry. But Mike, you're just introducing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a 4-minute PowerPoint presentation I was going to start with, so I'll just bag that. It's a project I worked on with the Department of Forestry and the Oregon Forest Resources.
You'll furnish it to us. We'll look at it.
Okay. You actually have it now. I couldn't email it. It's too big.
Okay.
It's a retrospective of mills and employment in Oregon from 1980 through 2010.
We may come back and do a whole thing just on that. How's that?
That'd be great.
Okay.
It's basically we've lost 3/4 of our mills and 2/3 of the employment in rural Oregon timber mills in that 30-year period, and it's a pretty graphic presentation.
Three quarters
of the mills. Yeah. There were almost 400 mills. Now there are 100. There were something like 47,000 direct jobs, and now that's under 20,000. Mm-hmm. And there are reasons, mill technology improvements in mills and that kind of thing. But we used to have 8 billion board feet of timber harvest back in the 80s, and now we're down to 4 billion board feet. 80% of that's from private timberlands. The U.S. Forest Service has more mortality than they do harvest. In other words, each year, more trees die on the national forests than are taken off the national forests. And of course, the implications, drought, fire. So I didn't want to start as being a downer, but you have to start with timber supply. Mm-hmm. If you want to talk about rural Oregon and economic development in rural Oregon, we start with timber supply. There's the mills that are remaining are strong. It's a strong industry still. It's diminished because we don't have as much wood. I would say private timberlands are well-managed, productive. The concerns for private timberland owners are regulatory overreach. WOTUS is a concern. Of course, the Forest Roads case was finally resolved, where it was decided that a ditch along a forest road is not a point source of pollutants. So, you know, we work with the Forest Practices Act, with the Board of Forestry recently, last week, I believe, passed some new regulations on stream buffers. So we're always concerned on the forest land side that we keep our private forest lands economic to manage. That's what's really underpinning the economy. State lands could do better. The Elliott National, the Elliott State Forests are all aware of the issues there. They're losing money on a great asset. The Tillamook Forest is not harvesting anywhere near what it could be, and that provides money to counties and local governments and schools. How many more minutes, Mr.
That's Bill? About it. I will work with Representative Witt and figure out between our two committees when just a forestry thing to make it up to you, because I forgot. I got two people who drove all the way here who I got to get talking. So why don't I let you two go while we're in transit, have Mike introduce Jay on the phone, and JR and Gary, why don't you come up?
Thank you, Chair Clem. For the record, Mike Freese with Associated Oregon Industries. We represent about 1,500 businesses that are across the state. We just finished some regional tours where I had the opportunity to meet Jay, and there's some consistent themes, many about some of the challenges of doing business in rural Oregon, and some of those even include do not do more harm. A challenge of trying to run a business and be before you. Jay Farr has agreed to connect via phone, and he's president of Farr's True Value and Hardware in Coos Bay. Notable, I found out today that they are celebrating their 100-year, and which is quite an accomplishment. And Jay graduated from Yale in 1973 with a Bachelor of Science in Chemical Engineering, and from Stanford with an MBA. So go ahead, Jay. Thanks.
Yeah, but what high school? That's what I want to know.
the good high school down here.
Once a pirate, always a pirate.
Yeah, I think so.
That's what I'm talking about. Okay, sorry, hometown joke. Okay, go ahead, Jay. Welcome.
Yes, thank you, and thank you for the opportunity to make a testimony over the phone rather than investing 8 hours in travel. The case I'd like to make this morning is for the rural small business, homegrown business, and that is under siege by large regional big box stores and other outside businesses coming to Oregon. There are days that go by that we feel that our sales are actually, almost have a feeling that our sales are going backwards with the number of contributions we're at to be involved with for small local nonprofit agencies, educational entities, and different school projects. And today, small rural Oregon, the number of locally owned businesses is definitely on the decline. And whatever can be done to make it easier for small locally grown to survive and to prosper, it's going to make a big impact on our local community. Not only in terms of dollars and cents contributed to various organizations, but also in the number of volunteers who are involved in brewery, lion, other service organizations in our area. We happen to be a fairly unusual hardware business that our two stores' employees are union employees, and so I feel even more beat up by businesses in our area that do not end up full health care, which we do for all of our employees. All of our employees are also under a plan that gives them a pension, et cetera, et cetera, so that our labor cost approaches $25 an hour.
Jeez.
Many of our local big boxes, our employees are on assistance, public assistance, health care, and other services from the community. So that the expense to our community for a big box to arrive in town is not an economic development improvement, a real deterioration.
So, Jay, this is Brian Clem. One conversation I had recently was with a florist over in North Bend. She just sold it recently. But I was talking to her about sick leave and some other things, and she brought up to me that if it weren't for Safeway's flowers, they might not be such a big issue. But because of the competition from the Safeway flower shop, it made these other things just much more challenging to figure out how to afford. Is that sort of your feeling? You've got the competition from the big guys plus some costs, you know, well-intentioned costs, but some costs.
Well, and yes, so our the local large outside organizations and corporations are part of our competitive picture. The emerging competitive picture is in it.
Oh yeah.
And so I just fear for small business and throughout the country. So that would be point number one. Number two is that we have an issue with our youth. And when I was growing up and in high school, I had the opportunity to work in our own business and other people of my age had the opportunity to work in other businesses. Today, those opportunities are largely only available in fast food. And part of that is a liability concern to employ anyone under 18. But at the time, a number of years ago, we had a fabulous program with our local high school where students were able to intern in our business get an opportunity to learn how to work and what the real world is all about early on their career before they emerged from high school and were thrown into the larger labor market.
Now you did not say that because that was my mom's program, did you?
Oh. Would that have had something? Well,
oh,
certainly.
Oh.
But your mom is who I was.
Well, that's nice of you.
She did a fabulous job of helping us to employ some local students and giving them the opportunity
to learn parents.
What the real world is. Workforce is all about. The third area I'd like to talk briefly about is shoplifting. And smaller businesses are much less sophisticated in their shoplifting insurance. And whatever the legislature could do to improve our chances of limiting that loss would make a big difference in the survivability of our small businesses around the state. My understanding is that the demand letter limits have not been changed in probably 30 years. We have had pushback from local police, law enforcement, not wanting to come to the store if we could improve that the amount of merchandise was over $7 figure. So there, which you know makes some sense, but many times shoplifting is kind of an entry level.
That's interesting. Serious crime. So perhaps if we had grants for some cameras and things versus maybe hiring another person to study the problem, you would rather just have the cameras?
Well, I think education of two retailers of what our opportunities and limits are, how we go about addressing shoplifting would be good, and educating local law enforcement about how important it is to get a handle on shoplifting in the small rural.
Hey, Jay, I'm going to ask you to hang on there. We've got two more gentlemen to go, and I'm afraid they're going to come kick us out of the room, and they drove a long ways, and I should have started with them. So if we can hold your questions, go ahead. Well, we're going to go until they toss us out. But, Jay, hold on a sec. I'm going to let these other gentlemen go for a few minutes, and then we'll come back to questions.
Very good.
Yep. I guess I'll go.
Thank you. He drove, so he gets to go first.
Yeah, he rode with me, so... Chair Clem, members of the committee, my name is Gary Neal. I'm the general manager of the Port of Morrow. I've been fortunate to be, you know, involved in economic development in rural Oregon for the past 26, 27 years. Based on our experience, you know, it's always a challenge of doing business. It doesn't matter whether you're in a rural or a metropolitan area, but the things that I try to focus on are identifying how to overcome some of those challenges. But some of it comes down to basic infrastructure needs. You know, I have communities in my jurisdiction that have water and sewer requirements, and they have a challenge of figuring out how to accomplish putting those improvements in. So if you don't even have the basic infrastructure, it's very difficult, if not impossible, to have a conversation about even doing business or creating jobs or maintaining jobs. And so I know that Lynn Schessler, I think he's still in the room. Yep, he is. You need to keep him on task and not let him retire because the Infrastructure Finance Authority does a great job in trying to assist our communities throughout the state. And those communities really need those basic services. And one of the other pieces that goes along with that is housing in rural communities. You know, we create a lot of jobs at the Port of Morrow, but and a lot of people commute in to the port to use for those jobs. But the problem we have is, how do we have housing in our communities for those people who live? Not only home ownership, but also rentals. We have a real difficult task in rural communities, and how we're able to deliver the market to those that workforce. In my experience, it appears that, you know, the state does a great job in assisting and putting resources in income-restricted housing throughout our state in rural communities. But, you know, we're trying to create market jobs, and we do create a lot of market-driven jobs, but there's no housing programs that put investment in those communities, and lenders and developers have a tendency in small markets to not invest. And so how do you get there from here? And it's a difficult task. Appraisals are almost impossible to get for comparables. So you end up somebody trying to build a home or even purchase a home in a rural community, and there's no comps to support the values that you need to acquire a home. Rentals, people get jobs. They don't know if they are going to be there long term, so they are looking for a place to rent. Well, guess what? We don't have market rentals either. So it's a difficult task. And maybe your banking industry and our savings and loan folks could maybe help you come up with some strategies to approach how do we bridge some of the challenges that we're facing in rural Oregon for filling that gap as well. Workforce training is another key component of what we're working on. Our industries, we've sat down with them, and we've established, along with our local community college and our local ESD district and our high school, we've actually sat down and established curriculum and identified ways to fill what their needs are in semi-skilled workforce requirements. We talk about minimum wage in this state. What we need is qualified workforce to be able to fill the jobs that we're creating that have good family wage jobs. And so we have teamed up with Blue Mountain Community College and IMESD in Morrow County School District, and we're having a workforce training center built at the Port of Morrow as well. And that's with the curriculum through our high-tech industries have established it. They're actually supplying teachers in those classrooms to deliver those services. And our industries in the food processing industry have established curriculum, and they're also engaged because they're looking for that qualified workforce as well. And I know that water, JR is going to touch on that, but that's a key factor. But, you know, we cannot continue to burden the businesses in this state with more and more reasons why not to do business here. And I'm concerned about some referendums that are being touted about the 2.5% gross tax. I mean, you know, we're already trying to keep businesses here. We want them to grow and expand. You heard about Grow Oregon. Well, they're going to grow out of Oregon if we layer on some of these business taxes that are being discussed. Minimum wage, let's just make good family wages so our youth can have an opportunity to have a job during school. Otherwise, businesses will stop from having those jobs available to our kids during summer months as well. So I guess there's a lot of challenges, but, you know, you're here to help solve some of these problems. One of the other things we talked about was transportation briefly. You know, the Port of Portland issues are all of our issues, and I think they need help from the legislature. It's not just a Port of Portland challenge. It is a state of Oregon challenge. My industries need to get to the export markets, and we're figuring out how to work around it. It's at an increased cost, and sure. But the best option for us is to make that gateway a gateway again, and so it's everybody's, I think everybody can win if that happens. I know the folks from Portland keep talking about, oh, we have so many more trucks on the road today because of the Portland problem. Well, you know what? Interstate commerce and transportation and the gateway out of this is going to help. And so we need those, we need that support as well. And I, you know, lots of things going on, but appreciate anything that you can do to help in all of the areas I think that are critical to doing business in Oregon. Thank you.
Thanks for making a long drive. JR, you'll wrap us up here quickly,
yeah,
I know.
Thanks, Chair Clem, members of the committee. I actually I enjoy the travel, especially when I get to ride with somebody as smart as Gary and we get to fix the world's ills in 4 hours on the freeway. But one thing I just want to say is I'm kind of excited that Representative Clem invited me to sit on this panel and talk more than just about water, but about rural natural resource-based economic development in general. And a lot of what we're learning about water can translate or transition over to some of the other issues we've heard about today. And I'm going to boil it down to three specific key points. One is legacy issues. Legacy contaminants are legacy environmental issues. I want to touch on those. Scale, the scale of our our regional economic hub versus the scale of rural development in general, and some of the struggles we face there in terms of defending our need for larger funding requests to maintain this hub versus some of the smaller in scale, but the same beneficial developments in some of the smaller rural areas of the state. And I'll wrap it up with a little discussion about precedence, but these are all, you know me, I'm verbose.
And you got about like
1 minute,
these
each.
Senators out yeah, there yeah, are going to yeah. kick so, us out.
So in terms of legacy, the one thing, and I think we're making good progress, but in this state, we've been, our regulatory agencies and natural resources have been reactive in nature, which was very easy when we were just permitting. Now we're at a stage where science has caught up. We know there's some issues that were developed way back when we were first developing some of these regions, and they're still there, both water quality legacy issues and water quantity. And with water resources, we've taken a good step in the right direction with a three-pronged approach. It'd be great to see DEQ get some of the same resources and some of the same opportunities to look at technological advances in water quality improvements, such as reuse opportunities. We've got a lot of independent land application permits from our processors. It makes better sense if we can regionalize those permits, get one effluent line that, in working with DEQ, some monitoring around it that's not paid for just by the ag base, but also a partnership with DEQ to look at some innovative approaches to fixing, not just regulating our water quality issues. The second is in terms of scope and scale. Our regional hub, West Umatilla County, North Morrow County, provides 54% of the employment for the entire region. And their infrastructure demands, both in terms of transportation, water supply, and water quality, a great example, these regional effluent lines, very much larger than what you'd normally see in a rural scale. When we go to try to defend our ability to obtain a larger chunk of money, even though the economy of scale is there, our returns are 2-to-1, 3-to-1 on that same investment. But a lot of times it's looked at direct job creation in that area. And our job creation doesn't just create the jobs in our hub, but the ancillary jobs that are, you know, a great example is the finance sector in Pendleton and the real estate sector and all the way down to the Port of Portland. If we can factor in those jobs and look at, in an economic model, the benefit of some of these regional urban scale infrastructure project on the entire economic generator of the state, maybe people would see that these are a lot bigger bang for the buck than just the direct job creation. And that has caused a few problems with us in terms of when people see the numbers, you know, the cost of our pipelines, when they look at the returns, things make a little bit better sense for them. And so a model in working maybe with IFA and now hopefully the Water Development Program, maybe we can get there in terms of defending these a little bit better. The last thing, and I think the biggest, is precedence. Place-based planning is inherently going to be locally driven with local solutions. It's hard to implement. I've said place-based planning is great. We need to figure out a way to get a pathway to place-based implementation. And the only way we get to place-based implementation is if we discuss the precedence argument, the death by a thousand cuts. What we're struggling with in the main stem of the Columbia is that if we allow you to do X, Y, and Z under the mitigation rule, how does that translate to mitigation in a small tributary or to a municipal development in Medford? Until we get to the point where there's some flexibility and some cover for the state agencies to be able to look at, let's take a look at the 1988 basin rules again and look at place-based structures. It's not new. I like to say we have four place-based plans in our basin. The 1986 task force that Governor Attia appointed, the 88 basin report, the 2005 task force, and the 2012 CRUST report from the governor's office, all of those are place-based in nature, but we're still struggling with a way to address the precedence issue to get to place-based implementation. I think until we get to that point, in terms of the water supply debate, we're going to have some really good plans, but everybody's going to be scared to implement them. I talk fast. Those are my 3 points for the day, and I'll be quiet for the rest of the day.
Hopefully. That's good. Yep. Anything else for the good of the order, Representative Witt?
Yes, if Ms. Nash could send some kind of communication to the committee and the members as to, from her vantage point, how she sees us beginning to recapture container cargo in the state of Oregon, I think would be critically important to our state's economy.
$200 a load of pears right now, every single one.
Unbelievable.
Yeah. Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If we are not going to ask for 5 or 10 minutes from the other chair, which I would recommend.
We're not going to get 10 more.
Then I would at least like to thank you two for driving here. I enjoyed every one of your invited testifiers.
Absolutely.
But no more than these two. And I would go back to the first testifier, Mark Long, who said, I know you know to this committee, one size does not fit all. And I believe that's true. The members of this committee are on this committee because we care about your parts of our state. However, as well-intentioned as many things are out of this building, we need to go to them. We need this committee to go to them. We need this legislature to visit parts of our state. Because unless you see it, unless you talk to the leaders, unless you go into the hardware store in Coos Bay, you're going to forget if you're from the Valley or Portland. And I'll leave it at that.
Thank you for coming.
I appreciate everything you said.
We used to do more policy committee roadshows. Now we do ways and means, but the policy committees don't often because we have these things here. And I think when we didn't have these here, we used to schedule more field trips. But not that we can't do it. We just need to remind ourselves that not everybody only cares about budget and money. They also care about the policies set by this building, and we don't usually do policy roadshows.
Mr. Chair, when we were discussing retrofitting this building for seismic upgrade and moving over to one of the buildings, we're not going to do that, apparently. We're not going to fund that. I saw it as an opportunity, and I had a bill, a concept, to say, no, we're not going to meet in some office building. For 6 months, we're going to rotate, and we're going to meet in the stadium at the Roundup for a month. We're going to go to Coos Bay to your high school for a month and make us, I get to sleep in my bed every night in Silverton, make us do what he does, go where we're meeting and get to know that community. I saw it as an opportunity.
I think it's a great idea. We don't want to demean District 21 where we're sitting too much because it's a decent district, but we shall return when the building is done. Okay, great. We share a district now. Remember, we merged our two, so you got to think about all those restaurants.
I get that, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you all for coming so much, and you too, if you want. I have 10 or 15 extra minutes before my next deal, so we can talk outside. Thank you, and thank the Subcommittee on Public Safety for letting us have the room for 15 extra minutes. And we are adjourned. Letting us have the room for 15 extra minutes. And we are adjourned.